I am Plot on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. David Finkel joins me again. His new book, Thank You for Your Service, has just been published and is getting outstanding notices. It's an often raw, heartbreaking, and powerful book that looks at the lives of soldiers who've returned home who have to face a new war, an after-war. Mr. Finkel was on was last on 4 years ago for his remarkable book, The Good Soldiers. He had been embedded with the men of the U.S. 216 Infantry Battalion in Iraq. They were some of the first troops sent to Iraq as part of the surge in 2007. In his latest book, he follows some of the men, the same men, as they reintegrate into society, their families as well, to return to their new lives. This book portrays the tremendous struggles that these men face, the system they have to navigate, and the family members so affected by the war experience. For some of the soldiers depicted in the book, their wounds aren't necessarily physical. They're traumatized psychologically, some suffering from PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or traumatic brain injuries. The book is often harrowing, but it comes from a place of great humanity and understanding. It's a tough book to read, but riveting and necessary. David Finkel is a staff writer at the Washington Post, where in 2006 he won the Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. Last year he received a MacArthur Genius Grant. He joins me from his home in Washington. The book is published by Bond Street Books, an imprint of Doubleday. Please welcome back to the Plot Online program, David Finkel. Mr. Finkel, good morning.
Well, good morning. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. As I told you before we started, this is such a moving book, and I remember Adam Schumann, for example, from the first book, and that remarkable episode where I guess they were on a rooftop, and there's a firefight, and Michael Emery, a fellow soldier, is shot, and Schumann takes Emery off the rooftop down several flights of stairs over his back, and there's blood gushing out of Emery, which some of it gets into Schumann's mouth, and he's tasting that months down the line.
Exactly. Well, he's tasting it still.
Yeah.
This is going to be a taste and a smell that doesn't leave a person once they become so infected with it, and that's certainly the case with Adam Schumann.
And so his story is the sort of central thread in the book, and we start the book with him and his, I guess, his diaries, right?
Well, no, the book starts 2 years after he had to leave the war, even though he was regarded as such a great soldier.
Yeah.
Just the accumulation of events, including what you just described, all caught up with him. And after 1,000 or so days in combat, he had to leave early, and instead of leaving the war feeling a sense of accomplishment that he had done a fair and good job of carrying out the policies of the war he was sent to carry out, instead he left feeling pretty hangdog, guilty, and with a sense of shame. And in the new book, it's 2 years later, and Adam and his wife are back home in Kansas, and their life has been difficult because of his psychological war wounds. But this is an evening, right 4 days after they've given birth to a new baby, and his wife is exhausted and asks Adam if he can hold the baby while she gets a little sleep. It's the middle of the night, and she looks at him, and even though it's been tough, she trusts him enough to think that this is something he can do, and she falls asleep, and soon after he falls asleep because he's just so tired all the time, and falls asleep, and the baby rolls out of his arms and off the edge of the bed, hits the floor hard enough for the sound to wake both of them up. And even though the baby is okay somehow, it's really a brutal moment, and the story of what happens in there after war is fully underway at that point. And like I said, it's there's some corners of hope in it, but there are also some corners of despair.
Now, how old is he?
Adam is at that point, he's in his late 20s.
Yeah, and so you look at him. He didn't have any limbs come off or anything like that, or not even a scratch, really. But the injuries are there, aren't they?
They are there, and he and other people portrayed in the book all said a version of the same thing. These are all, I mean, the book focuses on families trying to recover from the psychological wounds of war, not the physical wounds. And person after person would say, if he could just look in the mirror and see a physical representation of injury, a missing leg, a missing arm, a missing eye, something different, something asymmetrical, then they wouldn't have any problem believing something was wrong with them, and it would be easier to heal. But even these people who are so clearly wounded, some days have a difficult time believing it themselves. So sometimes healing begins with the difficulty of having to persuade yourself that there's something to heal at all.
And for people around them, people that they encounter, I mean, there's some convincing that has to happen too, right?
Sure. I mean, look, in every culture, and the two sides of it, whether it's civilian or military, there remains a stigma associated with a mental health wound, with a psychological wound. And whatever, you know, we might think of it as we make our way through civilian life, it's doubly amped up when you're in the military and when you're a gung-ho guy who's a member of the infantry, where you go to war feeling invincible, and then you'd sort of you take it from there.
Well, when was it that you realized you had to cover, say, the other story, that of the coming home?
Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I had realized it sooner, but it wasn't until after the first book, The Good Soldiers, was published. That was a, you know, we've talked about it, but this goes back a couple of years. It was a really intimately drawn account of what happened, not what happened. It wasn't so much about the Iraq War, but it used the Iraq War to write intimately about what happens to a young man when he goes to war in what is presumed in that war to be the lost moment, really the tragic moment. And that's what the Iraq War had become in 2007 when the surge was announced. And these guys went off into it, and it really did seem like they were entering tragedy. Now, that happened in a lot of cases. They had a rough deployment, and when they came home 15 months later, they were changed. That's what the first book is about. And after it was published, some of them began getting in touch with me to say that they just didn't feel right. They were having difficulty sleeping. They were having nightmares. They were feeling anxious. There was some depression. At some point, there were a couple of suicide attempts among the men I had written about in the first book. And that's when it became clear that the tragic part of it was unfolding now, and that there was the second volume ought to be done. If I paid attention to men going to war, then I ought to pay attention to what happens when they come home.
But I think that's not unique to you. I mean, I think a lot of us who follow current affairs never really thought about the afterwar. I mean, even today.
Yeah, it's funny, though, because when you look through literature, I'm not the first person to write about war, and you can go pretty far back and see that war is often told in two volumes, the war itself and the afterwar. And, I mean, I'm not getting on myself for not realizing it sooner. I'm just saying that it did take the publication of the first book to shake loose stories from these guys about, and their wives and their girlfriends and their family members, about what was happening now. And that's when I, you know, instead of sitting around, I got busy on the second volume.
Yeah, because I do have the sense in this country, especially because we have troops in Afghanistan, and some have come home, and we're expecting more to come home shortly, that we aren't thinking about what they have to go through. I mean, it's heartbreaking when we see the examples of the book from the people in the book. I mean, just even simple things like if you've got a traumatic brain injury and you have all this paperwork to fill out.
Right.
I mean,
right.
it doesn't make sense, especially if we've asked these people to serve us.
Well, I think the examples in the book underscore what you're saying. But in terms of, there's a larger point that these wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, have just seemed so far away, so distant from day-to-day life, especially here in the U.S., hard time articulating this. I've been thinking about it lately. But the difference is this part of the war is not as easily dismissed because it's not there. It's here. It's in communities across the country. It's the estimates are there are probably 500,000 or so Americans who have been sent into, of the 2 million who have gone into Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe 500,000 of them have some kind of psychological wounds. So I think what happens if you're a reader of these books and you read about Iraq, it can seem the war over there. But when you read these stories, I mean, these stories are here. These stories are the folks next door. And it's not as easily dismissible because it's current, it's ongoing, and in terms of proximity, it's no longer over there. It's a story that's taking place right next door. And if you read it, I mean, as you said, in what you were saying at the beginning, well, if I can take it a beat farther, these are they're very recognizable people.
Exactly.
And when you read what they're going through every day, rather than assume to know what they're going through every day, it's pretty compelling stuff, and it's heartbreaking, and it's gorgeous, and it's worth knowing about, I think.
Now, several years ago, your paper got a lot of attention for its exposing the conditions at Walter Reed Hospital, and I remember asking you 4 years ago about how the troops were being treated at home when they came home. What were some of the challenges that you report on in this book, and are there? There are still challenges with the VA and how our troops reintegrate into larger society.
Well, the Walter Reed stories that the Washington Post did, remarkable stories, that had to do with the system in place to treat soldiers who were coming home with physical injuries for the most part. Now, with every physical injury, there's going to be associated psychological trauma. But just in terms of the people who have been coming home, not with physical wounds, but with mental wounds, the system was slower to develop. Now, there is a system in place here. Unlike any war in American history, now if someone comes home and screws up the courage to say that maybe he needs some help, there is a system in place to offer help. But as the examples of these guys in the book show, there may be a system, but it is overwhelmed. It is, and maybe worse, it's just so haphazard. I mean, there's one guy who I read about at length in the book, who acted by any measure heroically in the war, but that didn't save him from needing help, and he went into a PTSD program that lasted 7 weeks. He had 7 weeks to work on it. Another guy in the same unit who needed help wanted to go to the 7-week program, but it was full. There was a long waiting list, so he ended up in a 4-week program. And it may be a good program, but one is 4 weeks and one is 7 weeks. And the reason you go into one rather than the other isn't because one is better suited to deal with your particular problem or issue. It's the one with an opening. Then there's a third guy. He needed help. The 7-week program was full. The 4-week program was full, and his caseworker kept looking around until she found a little program in California, and that one, it's at least 4 months. So, you know, pretend you're the father of this kid who went to serve, and now your kid needs help, and 4 weeks versus 7 weeks versus 4 months, where do you want your kid to go? You want your kid to go to the one where he has the best chance of getting better. And so I guess that's just a long way of saying that there is a system here, much like Walter Reed was improved. This one has been improving, but it's got a long, long way to go.
Do you think there wasn't any, say, forethought in the planning of the war, of the wars, I should say, as to the after-war and what happens to troops that come home?
Well, I want to be careful about overreaching. I don't know what the planning involved. I didn't report on that, so I don't want to pretend to know the answer. I just know the examples show that at some point the U.S. Army realized it had to do something more than it was doing, and it began setting up systems of help. But whether it's the active army or for the folks who are out of service now, the VA system, anybody in that system, either of those systems, no matter how hard they work, no matter how good their intentions are, nobody's going to say that these systems are working very well for the most part. In some cases, it's episodic. It's some guys, it's working out pretty well, and some guys, it's the same old thing where they're just kind of getting left behind, and that's a shame.
And then I guess the other thing to worry about is how those of us here, those of us at home, reduce all of this to, say, a transactional sort of that these people have served, and so they're owed certain things. I mean, that's not the way we should look at service, and especially in a system where these people have enlisted, right?
Well, I don't know. What do you think about that? I mean, the folks who have joined the service, I mean, it's not a draft, right?
Yeah.
It's a professional army. It's a volunteer force. As one wife says to one husband in the book, you knew what you were getting into, and I don't feel sorry for you at all. Now, that's a pretty brutal line.
Yeah.
But it reflects the thinking of some people. But others would come down on the side of, well, it doesn't matter if it's a volunteer force. This is the force defending policies of a country, not designing the policies, but carrying out the policies. And if you go over there and you get screwed up, then you ought to have every chance to get better. I mean, where do you come down on it? Which side?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I think we owe our servicemen and women everything.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have to contend with, say, the domestic questions of well, whether we should or not. I mean, there are people who you know, as you said, the wife that had that comment to say about, well, you knew what you're signing up for.
Right, exactly.
And so, but there is, so there is that sort of psychological stuff that we have to overcome as a society, right?
The stigma.
That especially, yeah.
I mean, we're seeing it in so many forms right now. Look, it's. I don't know how closely you've been following this story in the National Football League about what some people would call hazing,
right,
with the Miami Dolphins player, and some people would call brutality. But the defense is going on fascinate me. You know, some people say you just have to man up. You know, if somebody's making fun of you, punch them in the nose, take care of it. And other people are saying, this is absurd. What are we even talking about at this point? And if we take it away from the arena of sports and entertainment into true life and death, I mean, look, I know from the reporting on the first book, from having lived with these guys 8 months, I know what a day can bring. They experienced it a lot. I experienced some of it for sure. And when you're in the middle of something that shakes you just down to your core, down to your bones, that is of course it's a life-changing thing. And it's something that's not easily dismissed. And it's in any war, any country, any time, any place, when that happens to you, what are your choices? The amazing thing about the folks I write about in the end, I thought, was just that every day they get up and try again. I found that to be, I guess if there's any bit of hope in the stories I tell that these folks are going through, it's that despite circumstances like falling asleep, like dropping a baby, like, as a result of that, driving around in the Kansas night with a gun pointed at your head wondering whether to live or die, in most of the cases, these folks keep going on. The soldiering continues, and they're trying to get better, and so are their families.
Yeah, that's the last part, especially the families, because that's what we see in this book that I think is necessary reading.
Yeah, it's very much a family book. The first one was about soldiers of war. This one is not just them at home, and I'm glad I can elaborate on that. This is very much a family story. Wives, children, parents,
mm-hmm.
Everybody sort of engaged in this process of not just making the wounded soldier better, but the families are wounded as well. When Adam Schumann left the war, came home, he came home to a wife who was thinking the first time she saw him that everything was going to be fine, everything was going to be wonderful. She was so excited. And then she saw him get off the plane and walking toward her, and he was gaunt, and he was haunted, and he was skeletal-looking. And in that moment, her heart sank. She just knew that this was starting for her as well. The war had come home to this family, and it was the entire family at war now, not just the man himself.
Yeah, and then didn't his wife say something about how much she was scared of everything and who he was now?
Yes. She had some nervousness, but then when she saw him, it all cemented into a kind of reality she was hoping against. So this is what war does. This is what we've got to deal with now. And over the course of the book, which really stretches in some ways from Adam Schumann's first homecoming in shame to a point a couple of years later when he has a second chance at a homecoming after going through a treatment program. What happens to his wife? She starts out so hopeful, and then day by day, she degrades as well, just like war degraded her husband. The after war is degrading her, and she's becoming angrier and more frustrated and less patient with what he's going through, and angry at herself for becoming impatient. And it's kind of a nice little cycle downward there until they start cycling upward.
Now, the people that are in this book, did you ever talk to them about what they thought of the war that they participated in and whether they regretted it?
No, if they wanted to bring it up, sure, I would talk to them about it. But my reporting style isn't to really interview. It's just to be present and go along and see what happens. So, in other words, if they were talking to somebody else about what the worth of the war, then that would become fertile material for the kind of reporting I do. But I know from having lived with them, these families, really for a couple of years in the reporting of this new book, that's not what they were thinking about. They weren't thinking about whether the war was worth it or not worth it, whether the war was won or lost. Nothing so grand. That was way too luxurious for what they were thinking. What they were thinking about is like this one guy keeps saying in the therapy group, what was I thinking? What happened to me? Who was I over there? It made so much sense to behave that way, and now I'm back here, and what I've got to figure out is, who was I? What was that about? And when he says, what was that about? Not the war. What was he about? It's a much more personal grappling going on.
The approach that you take in this book, which is what a lot of people have noticed in the notices that I've been reading, is the elegant way in which you depict these lives. And it comes from a very humane place. Now, this may seem like a silly question, but I'm sure you've been asked it already. Where does that come from for you? I mean, those are the skills of the reporter, but I think it's more than that.
Well, I haven't been asked that, so be patient with my answer.
Sure.
Maybe it starts, I've been doing this kind of reporting for a long time, and long enough to understand that all perfect people are imperfect, and that doesn't, no, forgive me, I'm rambling, I'm trying to make sense of this. It's just, I got to know these people over there, and a little bit, and I saw what they went through, and then when Adam Schumann left the war and caught a helicopter out of there, I mean, I was along with him. I know what he looked like that day, and I know he hadn't done anything wrong, but he left feeling he had done something wrong. When I write about a guy named Tassolo Ayeti who acted heroically when his Humvee was blown up and caught on fire, and he helped save a couple of guys, no one could save the driver who burned to death. I know what Tassolo was like that day because I was with Tassolo that day and on through the book. So I began this one with a certain level of understanding of what they had been through. So maybe it comes from there. Maybe it's that simple. this was a good unit. There were, as far as my reporting showed, there were no really bad guys. There were certainly no war criminals. There was they did as well as one might be able to do, for the most part. I mean, they weren't angels, but most, they acquitted themselves pretty well. So maybe with this new book, they get the benefit of the doubt, and the benefit of the doubt leans toward compassion and humanity. They, where's the blame, right? Wherever it resides, and this book doesn't answer to get into blame or agenda or anything like that, but wherever the blame resides, it's not with these people. They were carrying out policy. That was their job, and they did it well by every measure of measuring these things, and it screwed a lot of them up. So what can you do at that point except watch them from a humane point of view? Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. And it builds into to what I want to ask you next. I mean, we're talking close to...
I mean, I guess, and let me...
Yeah,
the point isn't to lionize them, to say that these were the greatest people ever or the worst people ever, because life is lived between the extremes,
exactly.
No matter who I'm writing about. And
yeah.
That's where they're living life. These are not the bad guys of war, and they're not the great guys of war. They are the guys of war and the families of war. And that's why I think their story resonates so much.
Yeah, and it resonates in this country especially. You have Romeo Dallaire and Carol Off, who provide
right.
Prefaces to this book in this country, in the edition that's in Canada,
right.
Because it's something that we certainly have experienced and will in the coming years as we come home from Afghanistan.
Right. So in these, I mean, there's great universality to these
mm-hmm.
stories. It's a story about Americans, but it's certainly not an American story.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, we are talking close to Veterans Day in your country and Remembrance Day up here. Do you find that the public, the general public, if you will, especially those of us who don't have a personal connection, say a family member or a friend over there, that there is some work that we need to do in recognizing our servicemen and women? I mean, the title of the book, some people have said it's ironic, but I don't think it is. It's something that I mean, I've said it to people on the program who've come on who are veterans, but I don't think I've thought about what it means. And I think
well, I'm glad to hear that, because no, I didn't mean it in any kind of judgmental or ironic way.
Yeah.
I meant this is a ubiquitous phrase, and it's, I'm not questioning whether it's said sincerely, but if you read the stories that are between the covers of this book, you're going to have a better sense of some of the people you're thanking and some of the things you're thanking them for.
What their service is about, yeah.
That's the point of the title. I don't know. I was on a flight last night from Denver, Colorado, back to my home in Washington. And the doors closed, and the pilot said, in case we have any active military on board or veterans, I'd just like to say thank you for your service. And the whole plane burst into applause.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, that's an interesting thing. It's genuine, but as some of the soldiers I've been with when this has happened before have said, it's genuine, but how much is it understood?
And, exactly.
And they're not trying to make fun of the people who may not understand it. They're just hoping people will understand it.
Yeah, and that's the work that we have to do, right?
Well, it's the work I tried to do in the book.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is ground level hard stuff. It's based on a couple of years of really living with these folks and seeing how their lives, because of a war experience, have gone out of control in their attempts to kind of reel the thing in and let it make sense again.
David, it's been such a pleasure talking again, and in reading this book. I mean, it's not a pleasure to read the book, because it's a tough book in many instances, but it's such a moving one that I'm really glad I read it. It's a necessary read, and I hope a lot of other people read it.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk about this, and it's always such a good conversation with you.
Thank you very much. The book is called Thank You for Your Service. It's from Bond Street Books, which is an imprint of Doubleday. The Washington Post, David Finkel, joined me on the line from Washington in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.